welcome to the second episode of Bossy Books. My name is Heather, and I am joined by my good friend across the seas, Minju.
Hello!
We are just two shamelessly bossy girls sharing our amateur opinions about books in order to become internet famous and preserve our fragile long-distance relationship, made even more fragile by what Minju has just done. Minju, tell the world what you have just done.
Nothing much.
Mm-hmm.
Well, basically, we already taped this, or not taped this. We already did this for 50 minutes, talking about this book that I didn't even really like. Anyways, this book for 50 minutes. 50, 50, and I realized my computer stopped recording, so starting again.
When did it stop recording, Minju?
Like 1.5 minutes?
By the way, for the record, it was 53 minutes. And it was some of our best work. There was some pure gold in those 53 minutes, and now it is all gone.
Well, maybe it's going to be even more refined now.
I don't think so.
Maybe I did all of us a favor.
You can't recreate that kind of thing. It happens once.
Anyways, now it's been 2 minutes, and it's still recording. So we're off to a great start.
Oh my gosh.
Anyways, this month, our book is called The 100-Year Flood by Matthew Salicis. I've totally not talked about this book before. It's very fresh and new to us. This book is about a Korean guy who's 22. His name is T, and he was adopted by an American couple when he was a baby. And we enter his life after a month or two after the September 11 attacks in America, when his uncle commits suicide because T's dad was found to have an affair with his wife, so his auntie. This also sends T's parents' marriage into a disarray, and so T himself flees to Prague. And while he's in Prague, he befriends an artist called Pavel and his wife Katka and their friend Rockefeller. And there's also a very big flood, obviously, from the title. That is a brief on the book that we're talking about today that we haven't talked about before. So, yes, what did you think of the book, Heather?
Okay. I just need to get the rage out of my voice.
I think you should keep it.
Does it make things more interesting?
Yeah, I like it. I like it.
Okay, yeah. There'll be an undercurrent of rage throughout this entire podcast. I hope everyone is entertained. So the book, 100 Year Flood by Matthew Salicis. We found this book by searching on the internet for good books to read. Recent books that have come out in like the fall.
Yeah.
And this showed up on a couple of lists because... this showed up on a couple of lists and we were interested in it because it has a Korean protagonist, and that's very rare.
Mm.
And so that's what drew us to this book. And at first we were kind of like, why is a white guy writing about an Asian main character? Only to find that Matthew Salicis is in fact a Korean adoptee. So he is ethnically Korean. And so, yes, he is allowed to write about Koreans. We approve.
Yes.
And so he's a writer who writes a lot about race. And so I did expect this book to be more about that, to be about, you know, being a Korean American, you know, being an Asian in this big wide world.
Yeah.
It wasn't.
No. Yeah. So out of all the books that we researched, we chose this book because it had like a Korean American author. And we thought, and it was about a Korean American. So we thought, you know, oh, maybe we'll find something in common. You know, we will get the Korean in jokes and there'll be some references and things can be relatable. There'll be lots to talk about and things like that. But yeah, I didn't really find that it did that at all, which is quite surprising. I was expecting it to, but maybe like his name, like Matthew Salicis, he's quite, I don't know. I found it more, yeah. Yeah, it was more like... non-Asian than I thought.
Yeah, I understand, knowing now what the book's about, I understand why there is a lack of Asianness in it, but I was a bit saddened, well, a bit disappointed by it, because, you know, it's a very rare occasion where you get to read a book that is, you know, not written by a white person, written by an Asian person, and, you know, and a Korean person at that. So you would hope that there's something in the story or in the character that reflects your own experience. And so, yeah, like, whenever I read, you know, I have read books written by ethnic authors. So, like, people, like, Spanish authors, Indian authors, and they always include a lot of cultural references that I don't get because, you know, I'm not from that culture. But I would think, oh, you know, the reading experience would be so much richer if I understood all these references.
Yeah.
You want to be in on the in-jokes. But no, this is not that kind of novel. So if you are looking for something about the Asian or like the Asian American, Asian Australian experience, this is not it.
No.
It's a very different novel.
No. The only Korean word that they ever say even is 안녕하세요. It's like repeated like 3 times maybe.
And also his Korean, never reference, his Korean name.
Yeah. Yeah, you never hear that.
No, you do.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Kang Sulpun, right?
Very sad.
Yeah.
He translates.
Very, very sad.
He translates.
A river of sadness.
A river of sorrow. But.
Yes, apparently some Korean friend translated that for him. I'm like, well, that's very poetic.
It's a very poetic translation. I would translate it to Sadness Kang.
Yeah, I would be like, oh, your last name's Kang. Mine's Kim. Anyways, they never refer to like kimchi, bibimbap, bulgogi, you know, all the things you're meant to refer to.
Yeah. So there's nothing Korean about this book. Which makes sense in the end, because you realize that the entire book he is just trying to ignore and run away from his Korean history. But more on that later.
Yeah. So, you know, with having, like, an Asian protagonist, did you find him more relatable? So it would be a no.
No.
There was nothing.
Yeah. I didn't even find him relatable on, like, a human level.
Yeah, me too.
Because he's not a very well-drawn character. And knowing that this is not, like, a badly written book and that the author is a very seasoned writer, and to give him the benefit of the doubt, I feel like that must be deliberate.
Yeah.
You know, T is not a very well-drawn character. We don't really know anything about him. Like, we know facts about him. Like, we know that he's adopted, that his uncle just died, that he's in Prague. We know facts about him. And his feelings are also conveyed, but in a very abstract way.
Yeah.
So we don't really.
Super abstract.
Yeah, it's very abstract. So we don't really know, like, what he's feeling, what he's going through. Like, we don't know his personality. Like, if he was your friend, like, how would you describe him?
I wouldn't really know where to begin. Mm. Like, but I would just say that he's very, like, introspective, maybe moody, broody, like, really cares about where he came from. Like, just the things I can tell.
Yeah.
From the one-dimensional kind of character that's come out from this. So, yeah, I couldn't really relate to him. Maybe if I was an adoptee, maybe I could relate to him more. Maybe that's one thing we would have in common. But the Asianness, there was no thing in common. The obsession, like, you know, with Prague, I don't really know. I've never been, and things like that. Yeah. I couldn't find it relatable very much at all. You know, I had my suspicions, though, when I was like, is this Asian dude going to write about Prague? I was like, this is weird. I don't know how this is going to go down. A little bit racist.
An Asian person can't travel or write about Prague?
You know, one of the books that really surprised me was like, I forgot his name. Ishiguro Garo guy? This Japanese guy. You know the Berry Giant book? Yeah. Anyway, I had my suspicions. I was like, this Japanese guy is going to write about a historical time in British history, which is when the Berry Giant is set in. Mm. And I was like, no way. I was like, how? Why? Why is he trying to do this kind of thing? But it turned out the author grew up in Britain. So
yeah, he's a British Japanese person.
Yeah. And so I was like, oh.
Minju, that is totally racist.
I judged him.
Because white people write about non-white cultures all the time.
No, but I didn't expect him to do it very well.
Well, what about this book? Do you think he did a good job with the setting of Prague and making it believable?
Well, not really. Yeah, maybe it's because I've never been. Yeah, I'm not sure. I wasn't really entranced by Prague. The only thing I kind of got from it, there was like cobblestones and it was Europe.
It's an old city.
And it rained a lot. Yeah. Yeah. Well, because there's going to be a flood, but yeah.
I feel like my mom described Prague better than
he doesn't.
I mean, no, he does give some very detailed descriptions of Prague, but he doesn't do it in a way that is immersive. Like, he doesn't do it in a way that makes you feel like, oh, I'm there and I can see it and it seems so beautiful and I want to go there.
I think that's one of the issues I had with this book, though, or something I didn't expect was, like, how arty it was or postmodern it was, because he was always, like, talking in symbolism, lots of, like, imagery, and he was always skipping in periods of time, and, you know, he would sometimes be in, like, the hospital rehab clinic, which was the present after all the Prague stuff had happened. Sometimes he would be in, like, the past with his family and his adoptedness. Sometimes he would be in Prague, and sometimes there were ghosts, and, like, I just didn't know what was happening. And so, especially the first third of the book, I had a lot of trouble.
Oh, yeah.
And so, yeah, I think that might have played a part, in the relatableness and about Prague, caring about Prague,
It does jump around. It's not very fluid. Like, until the flood actually starts and it stays in Prague and the action really builds up and a lot happens.
It gets quite intense.
It does. It does in the second half. And it does get to a point where it does become a page turner. Like, you do want to keep reading. Like, I couldn't put it down at a certain point.
Yeah, that's right.
But I'd agree that the first half is a bit of a struggle.
Yeah, because you really have to just commit to it for a bit.
Yeah, and I feel like I only really committed to it because I knew that we had to talk about it in this podcast.
Me too.
I don't know if I would have made it. Another thing that got me through it was like it was like a challenge. Like, you know, I know that this is not a bad book and I really want to understand it, but I don't. But I'm going to keep trying. I'm going to keep going. Yeah. I'm going to keep trying.
Yeah, but that was one of the hardest things, though, was, like, I felt like there was, like, an overload of it, like, of symbolism and imagery. Mm-hmm. Like, there was just too much. I felt like every sentence, especially in the first third, seemed to be ridden with some kind of weight and some kind of, like, hidden meaning that I was meant to get that I didn't get. And, you know, I had to finish this book and, you know, this kind of thing. Mm. And so, yeah, there's an overload of symbolism, like, so much so that it was just, like, everything was just being drowned out because everything was screaming for my, like, double take and attention. And so I grew really tired of that pretty quickly, I found.
I think it's just a style of writing.
Okay, yeah.
Like, there are books like this. Like, have you read anything by, I know you're not a huge fan of Japanese authors, but Murakami?
Excuse me, do you need to tell the whole world? No, I
didn't say why you're not a fan. You just don't enjoy the Japanese style of prose, you know?
No, I haven't read Murakami, no.
Yeah, so, I mean, there are people who adore Murakami and, you know, they love him. And he's a very postmodern author as well. And I've only read one book by him, Norwegian Wood, and I hated it.
Okay.
Because it is, I think, it was a long time ago when I read it, but I think there are some similarities between that book and this in that the main protagonist is very lost.
Uh-huh.
And that lostness permeates the entire book.
Okay.
There is nothing that grabs you or anchors you. It's just thoughts. It's just thoughts and even the relationships.
Oh, that would really bug me.
Yeah. And even the relationships that the characters form kind of float around and it's hard to make sense of it.
Yeah. Nah.
And I'm sure there is something to be said for, you know, the poetry and the writing and the meaning behind it. But it's just not the kind of book that I really enjoy.
No. And there is a degree of that in this book. Like, a lot of it, because he's an adoptee, is about him being kind of displaced and he doesn't know where he belongs and who he is. And so there is a degree of like displacement, and there's that ghost that follows him, or he sees in the corner of his eye so much, but he doesn't know who it is and what it is and who he is. And so, yeah, even the flood itself was a huge symbol, the most overriding one probably. About displacement, about running away from your history or your history, and those
and
kind
having
of
it
things.
catch up with you in a very overwhelming, inescapable way.
What did you think about the flood analogy? What did you think?
I think at that point I stopped searching for symbolism, because that was when the narrative really picked up and there was action, and I did feel somewhat invested. I was like, I actually cared. Like, what is actually going to happen to these characters? So at that point, I didn't really sit back and think, oh, there's a flood. What does it mean? What does it say about what T's going through right now? Like, I didn't think of it like that. Did you?
Yeah. No, not in the moment. But I guess when I was looking back in the book, I was like, the flood is quite a huge thing that occurs. And since this book is so intense on symbolism, you know, I was thinking, oh, what does it mean? What's the imagery and things like that? It kind of reminded me of something T would say often, was that he would say he felt his container being filled.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that? Yeah. And he would, I felt like he was him, his heart or himself or something, right?
Yeah.
And so it was about, like, when things became too overwhelming or, it's like when, for people who bottle things in and your bottle gets full and you just kind of has to, like, flip a table. Yeah. And I felt like the flood imagery even was kind of like that, but on, like, a really big scale when, it was unavoidable now and it was, like, just taking over his world.
Yeah. And I mean, the metaphor of the container, he says it's the container of the things that he cannot say.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I think that the things that he cannot say but wants to say, they're the things that build up and eventually, you know, overwhelm him as the flood does.
Yeah.
But then that means that the rest of the book that leads up to the flood is really more about the unsaid than what is actually said.
Yeah.
And so I think that's why it's so hard to make an emotional connection with characters, and the narrative doesn't really grab you, because it's not actually about the story of what's happening or who these people are.
Yeah.
It's what's happening underneath. And it's hard. I get that, and I admire what Salis is trying to do there. It's just hard as a reader.
Yeah, so difficult.
Yeah, and especially when you start reading a book and you just expect it to be like any other book, like, oh, there'll be story, there'll be characters.
Yeah.
But it's actually this very, very deep book about what is not being said and what's going on underneath everything. I wish that they had kind of told me that up front. Yeah, so actually, after finishing this book and having a better understanding of what this book is actually about and what the author is trying to achieve, I went back and started reading the book again, which is something that I never do. Mm. Like, I hate reading books a second time because I feel like it's a waste of time when there are so many books that I have not read yet.
Yes, me too.
But I was just really, I was really determined to have a better understanding of this book, especially because of this. And I found myself actually enjoying the book a lot more on the second reading. I didn't read a lot of it, but just even those first few chapters when I first read them, I was like, oh, like, too much metaphor that are not related and too much thinking, like, what is going on? What is this book actually about? But then understanding the heart of this book, the soul of this book, and then going back to it, I enjoyed it a lot more. And I think if I had all the time in the world, I would probably read it again.
No, I totally agree with you, because I also hate rereading books. I hate rereading anything, actually. Like, I remember even doing exams at uni or whatever, and you're meant to, like, reread your exam to, like, make sure you did it right, but I was just like way too lazy.
Yeah.
Anyways, I was just one of those people who walked out early all the time. But yeah, with this book as well, when I finished it, because I actually just finished this book. I was like trying to finish it as fast as I can so we can do this podcast. As soon as I finished it though, I did have this really big urge to reread the first third, which I didn't understand, you know, and I felt like then I would really get it, you know, but like, I don't know. Does that mean it's a good book? I don't think so. You're meant to, I don't know. Do you know what I mean? Like, is it really a good book if it started off with a beginning you didn't really get until you finished the book? Do you, and you had to reread it? Do you know what I mean?
That's a very legitimate question.
Yeah.
I think it made me realize that there are a lot of different types of books.
Yeah.
That are all trying to achieve different things.
Yeah.
And I think a big thing about postmodern writing, I don't know a lot about it, but I think a big thing in it is challenging the reader's expectations of what a book should do.
That's true, yeah.
And playing with those things, those expectations around narrative and character, playing with those things and kind of playing with the reader, which is a bit mean, but it's a writer's thing.
No, that's good. So do you recommend rereading the beginning?
I do. I think you would be surprised how different it feels. Yeah, so I would recommend rereading at least a bit of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll try.
But yeah, I mean, back to the actual story. And
yes.
So people get a better idea, like, why there were parts of the story that were so frustrating that we have to dig so deep into this book to find something that we like about it. The love story between T and Katka. So Katka is the wife of this artist that T runs into. In fact, they find him. They find him on New Year's Eve when he's drunk. He's got his shirt off and they walk up to him and so naturally just say, "We would like to paint you." And so Katka is this tall, blue-eyed, beautiful Eastern European woman and they inevitably start an affair, T and Katka.
Yes, they do. Well, he falls in love with her first, I think.
He does. And he kind of comes onto her. And then, yeah, eventually they kiss and they start this affair.
Yeah.
And, but this, I love a good love story. Like, we all know this. Like, as soon as a love line appears in a book, I'm like, yes, this is.
Yeah, yeah, we know. We know from the last podcast,
like,
you love.
I'm like, as long as something has a good love story, I'm like, yeah, this is a great book. I love it. It's great. But this love story, I didn't really enjoy or find believable at all. Like, what did you think?
Yeah, I didn't find it believable at all, really. Well, yeah, no. Well, I found it believable that T might like Katka, which is how it kind of begins. But that Katka kind of, like, you know, responds to these feelings and returns them, I found to be quite, what the, like, yeah, I couldn't believe that. I think it had a lot to do with what I thought about T as well, because I didn't find him attractive at all. Like, his character or his personality, they never really describe him. You just know he's, like, half Asian. And so, yeah, I just didn't know why she would be attracted to him. I didn't find him attractive. I also kind of felt like maybe Katka was kind of, you know, because she would have been middle age and she's like European and from like the arty background. I thought she was like quite liberal, you know, and she was like looking for like some fling or like, you know, some lover on the side or something. Maybe that I could believe.
Yeah.
But there wasn't much about her that made me think she was that type. You know, it doesn't seem like, because Pavel was quite, I think he was quite a protective and jealous character. So it's not like,
yeah, he's quite,
you know, that was normal. Yeah, yeah, he's a possessive guy. And so, yeah, no, I couldn't believe it. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, the affair is inevitable. Like, you know it's going to happen just from the way T describes Katka when he first meets her.
Yeah. Obvious love interest.
She's like this vision that appears. Mm-hmm. Yeah. She's like a fantasy, like a fantasy woman, you know? You don't really know much about her except for the fact that she's extremely tall. She has piercing blue eyes. And she loves telling these mythical stories that T loves listening to. So,
yeah.
His attraction is obvious. But, yeah, as a reader, we aren't really given a reason why Katka would be attracted to T.
No.
There's a little hint that there's discontent in her marriage with Pavel, but
yeah.
there's not enough for you to really root for them to be together or really understand why they are together.
And also I found T like super annoying. Like he really aggravated me. I really found him to be like very immature and very self-centered. Like that's all he ever talked about was himself. Like all of T and Katka's dialogue is all about himself. And sometimes he asks about Katka's background, like her history and her family and things like that. And she'll share, but that's like 5% of their, you know, conversations. And so I found him to be like really self-indulgent, self-obsessed, like everything's about him and his past and his identity. He is like, I don't know, if I was like, it says that Katka's 15 years older than T. So T's 22, Katka would be 37. If I was a 37-year-old, I would be, I just would not find it endearing or cute or attractive or anything if I was with a 22-year-old who couldn't stop talking about himself, trying to find himself, all the issues in his family and his past. Like, that's all he ever talks about. And so I just, yeah, maybe she's got this motherly thing. I don't know.
I think that's a pretty valid theory. There, I think it's very possible that Katka was attracted to his lostness because that's what I think attracted Pavel and Katka to him in the first place when they saw this random Asian guy drunk with his shirt off dancing.
That's true. Yeah.
At New Year's Eve. And they probably saw him and thought, this guy has a story.
Yeah. Yeah. But that was even hard to believe too, right? Like how they ended up being friends. You know, oh, we want to paint you. And then T's like, okay.
Yeah, it was a bit unbelievable. It's like it's like a fantasy you would have if you're like traveling to some exotic country to find yourself.
Yeah.
Like you go and then you just happen to bump into these mysterious, good-looking strangers who are, for some inexplicable reason, intrigued by you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Anyway, So back to Katka and T. They embark on this affair, and then they continue to make very strange decisions that make no sense from like a real reality point of view, or even from a story point of view. When the storm comes, emergency workers come to their door and basically tell them that they need to evacuate, but then T just decides that he wants to stay and they do not leave their two-story apartment.
No. Yes, it is so odd.
It's stupidity. It's pure stupidity.
It is. It is. I don't understand. I just want to scream at them, like, get out. Get out, you know?
Exactly.
But yeah, there is a very interesting thing that T does in the book is when the emergency guy, he comes to the apartment and he knocks on the door and kind of tells T that they need to evacuate, but he's saying it in Czech and so he doesn't understand, but then the emergency guy goes as far to like call someone who knows English, and then on the phone the English guy in English tells him, you know, you need to leave. But this is around the day after when Katka has left her husband, and so she's actually staying with him, and so he finally feels like he has her, you know, all to himself, and so he actually pretends he's Korean. You know, which is so odd because the whole time he's not doing that at all. And so he actually says, 안녕하세요, you know, and to kind of show, I don't understand English either. Mm-hmm. And so then, so he pretends he didn't understand any of the emergency stuff. And so he just closes the door and Katka's still sleeping because actually throughout lots of this book, they're just like having sex all the time. And being tired and sleeping and then having sex again and then sleeping. And so she's so tired from...
Can you not be so crude? This is a G-rated podcast.
Oh, rolling around in bed, hugging, that she can't be awake for this conversation. Because she understands Czech fluently, obviously. And so, yeah, he kind of like hides it from her and... But she knows what's going on as well. Like, she's heard some warnings before and things like that. But they end up staying. Yeah. And the flood reaches to the second floor.
They both know that a flood is coming.
Yeah. But I think T is
I get it. You're annoyed that you've just started this awesome affair with this hot woman.
Yeah, and you got her.
It's so inconvenient that this flood happens to happens to interrupt your lovemaking sessions.
We can say lovemaking.
It is still like, yeah, we can. That's G-rated.
Okay.
It's still pure stupidity to not evacuate. But even adding to that is what Katka does, which is...
Oh my gosh.
She has a massive cut in her leg because... Pavel threw something at her as she left. I think that's what happened, right?
Well, he smashed some dishes and then it went into her leg as well.
Oh, I see, yeah. So she's got a pretty deep cut, but it's under her, like, knee-high leather boots or whatever. And she knows that it's a deep cut, that it's dangerous, and yet she doesn't tell T about it, and she hides it from him by keeping her boots on.
Yeah, for, like, 3-4 days or something that they're holed up in there. I found it really kind of like it got to me so much that when I was reading those passage, like that part of the book, my feet felt clammy. Like they felt sweaty and sticky. Like if you were wearing knee-high boots for 3-4 days while making love and sleeping and you're constantly wearing them. And it says that she was like wearing nothing but the boots, but she wouldn't take them off. And they're also wet because she walked through the rain and... it was filling up with blood, but she kept them on.
It would be disgusting.
And I was like, this is gross.
It would smell.
Yeah. It would be so clammy. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And so...
her feet would be like grandpa feet in there from the moisture.
And this is not just some disgusting detail of the book. Because of what she does, I guess the combined...
like some fetish.
The combined decision of them not evacuating the flood and her keeping her boots on leads to her untimely death.
Oh, God. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, spoiler alert.
Spoiler.
Her wound gets infected by flesh-eating bacteria, of all things, that spreads to her whole body, and it puts her into a coma. And while she doesn't actually die by the end of the book, it's heavily implied that she's not going to make it.
No, yeah. And I found that quite sad, actually. I felt for T for the first time in the book, right at the end, when on her deathbed, she's like, they're saying, she's like kind of saying the last remarks kind of thing. And she says to him, I don't know why, but I can't forgive you. As in, I can't forgive you for not taking us out, not protecting me, letting this happen to me kind of thing. As in, like, you caused this disease and I'm gonna die, you know. And I was like, that's such a mean thing to say. Like, both of you had played a part in this. It's not his fault you got a flesh eating bacteria. He also didn't know that you had this wound on your leg because you kept your boots on for like 3-4 days. I'm sure if he had known that, then they would have left and they would have gone to hospital or something. So like, for her to leave him with that, I thought was really cruel. And so I have a heart.
I didn't really see that as cruel. I saw that as very fair because, you know, when something that tragic and I guess in a way random happens to you, that is going to cause your death, you know, you think about what I could have done to possibly avoid this.
And
you know, the choice to not evacuate was pretty much T's choice. So I get it. Yeah.
Still mean to say it.
I'm sure there is some very profound symbolism in the fact that his reluctance in leaving the flood led to the death of his lover by something as undignified as flesh-eating bacteria, of all things.
You know, this point, I think, links very well with, like, I just had the thought. I feel like I have got some deeper meaning in this book. But even the fact that his refusal to leave something causing something bad, his refusal to confront something is causing something bad, is like linked with like something they say a lot in the book, like this kind of imagery is so basically, like, Pavel, he paints a painting of T, and lots of them, but one of them is of T holding the door for himself, but not long enough for him to go through himself. And so he talks about it a lot repeatedly throughout the book, like, what do you think that means? What do you think Pavel saw in me? Like, what is this riddle, you know? I think it's something profound about me, but I don't know what it is. And so he asks a lot of people, he thinks about it a lot and applies it to different circumstances. And so I think even that, the fact that he didn't leave, you know, and it turned into this disastrous kind of circumstance is also one of the things. Do you get what I'm trying to say? Yeah. I'm losing myself.
He's kind of in this state of inertia. Like he is running away from something, but he isn't really. Like, he's still stuck at that point. Mm. And even though he's in Prague, in a completely random and foreign country, even though he's having this adventure with these mysterious strangers, he isn't really moving. He's not going anywhere. He's stuck. And he's lost. And so, yeah, I think that's what that is. Like, he's him holding the door for himself but not letting himself through is that he's at this point where he knows that he has to confront his history, and there is a very deep but suppressed desire for him to do so. But he's just stuck in that moment where he's got the door open, but he's just not letting himself through. And and that actually... That also reminds me of this quote that is quoted at the very beginning of the book before it even starts. And it's a quote that when I read, because it's the first thing you read as you open the book. And when I read it, I was like, this makes no sense. Like, what is this meant to mean? And then I just forgot about it. But then going back to the beginning, I was like, oh, okay, this is what the book is actually about. The quote is, "We do not know what is happening to us. And that is precisely the thing that is happening to us. The fact of not knowing what is happening to us."
Yeah,
it sounds kind of obnoxious, right? Like, very, like,
oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's, but
that's basically what the book is like for the first third.
Yeah,
like weird stuff like that. Yeah, like deep stuff.
Those kind of obnoxious metaphors where you like need to actually stop after every single sentence and think, what is he saying? But
it does make sense after reading it, like you said.
Yeah, it does. It does make sense. So he's in this state of of not knowing what is happening, and he's in that state for the entire book until the very, very end, where it is kind of revealed in a conversation that he has with his dad that all of this is about his yearning for his birth mother. And I don't think we've mentioned it yet, but it is revealed midway through the book that his adoptive mother discovers that his adoptive father is actually his biological father. So the story behind T's adoption is that T's dad saw T, I guess, as a baby or being born in a hospital in Korea, and he just fell in love with him and took him home.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, a little bit... That's the story he's been told. Yeah, it's a little bit unbelievable to start off with. But then we later find out that...
Yeah.
He had actually impregnated a Korean girl on one of his trips to Korea, and so T is actually his son. And then at the end...
Which was quite... not too surprising, right?
Well, did you predict it?
Well, I was like, oh, this could be what's going on. Like, you know, I had my... I thought that might be true. So when that came out, as like a exclamation, maybe 2/3 of the book, I was like, duh.
Oh, okay.
Like,
so you saw and I it
couldn't
coming.
Believe that T. Yeah, and I couldn't believe that T did never thought of it himself, because T's mum tells him, like, when she's telling him that T's dad is his actual dad, that they look similar too.
Yeah.
And so I can't believe he never thought that.
Or maybe he was in denial.
Oh, is this the door thing?
Maybe it is. Maybe the door actually means like 10 different things about this one person.
Yeah, but, it does.
But yeah, so in the end we discover that one of the final lines is that he asked his father to tell him about his birth mother, and then it ends there. When I read that, I was like, oh, I get it. That's what this whole book is about.
Yeah, all the things that happened to him. That's what it was about, like why he went to Prague, why he had this relationship, why, you know, all this thing. It was just this one thing. And that's what, like, profoundly aggravates me about this book is that, why couldn't he, like, there was an obvious shortcut to this whole thing. Like, you didn't have to break up a marriage, you didn't have to travel overseas and like whinge and whine and like do all of that, have this like kind of global outworking of his internal, you know, problems and bother a whole lot of people and us. Like, I had to read the whole thing. You know, for him to get to this one conclusion. I was like, come on. You know, but
it is frustrating.
I'm cold-hearted.
It is just, it is frustrating from a reader's point of view because it's kind of like, like, couldn't you just have dealt with this in a very, in a mature adult way?
I mean, then, if he, he could have gone to any counselor, she would have said, oh, you're adopted. Maybe you are struggling with, I don't know why I have an American accent, but you know, like anyone could have told him that that could have been the issue, the birth mother issue, you know?
Mm. Reading this book made me think more about, oh, like, what would it really be like to be an adopted person? Because I don't have any adopted friends. It's not a common thing in Australia, not as, no way near as much as it is in the States. And so I don't really have any personal experience or know people who've had that experience. But then I thought about it and I was like, man, it would be really hard to not know anything about your life before birth.
Yeah, we take it for granted. The fact that
we definitely do, because it's like, oh yeah, we have parents and grandparents and they're our family. Like we don't think about what life would be like without that kind of history and how, you know, displaced you would feel. And
I think I would definitely recommend this book for like people that are adoptees. I feel like they are the ones that would really relate to this.
I think so.
This character. Yeah.
Because he does it in such a unique way. I mean, he could have easily written a story about him like traveling to Korea on the search for his birth mother and, you know, contacting adoption
agencies. That has been done a lot.
Learning about his path. Exactly. Like, it's been done a lot. So it's been done in a very different way, and it's done in a very unique way, which I appreciate now that I understand what he was doing, and that yes, in the end, it is a book about the adoption experience, the adoptee experience.
Sure.
It's a meditation on that, that confusion and that lostness that a person feels when they have no connection to something that everyone sees so obviously in their face.
Yeah. So where are you standing with this book at the moment? Would you recommend it? Are you glad you read it? Or you're just trying to make the best of what you've read?
I think both. I think at first, when I just finished reading the book with no context, I was kind of like, yeah, I don't, didn't really learn or gain anything from this book. There's nothing that I particularly like about this book. It's not a book I hate, but I wouldn't be like, oh, you need to read this book. I couldn't really think of anyone that I wanted to recommend it to.
Yeah, me too.
But I think reading more into the book, trying to understand it, trying to understand the author, has given me more open and kind feelings toward the book.
Not like me, who has just finished it and is annoyed.
And is going to forget about it and throw it away.
Yeah.
Donate it to some secondhand bookstore.
Yeah, probably. No, yeah. I mean, I think it's good as like in its literary kind of achievements, like because it is full of imagery and it is the way he describes things, it is beautiful. I think there's things to learn about writing and expression through it, but in characters and events, not so much.
Yeah totally. I think it is a book written for writers more than readers.
Yeah That's good. That's a good way to put it.
So I mean, I was a bit disappointed because we kind of had like lukewarm feelings about our first book, and I really wanted to love this book so that we could just have like a love fest about it. Because, you know, if you're doing a podcast about books, you kind of want it to encourage people to read. Yeah. But I think both of these books were kind of like, oh yeah, we probably wouldn't really like recommend it.
Yeah.
And so people are listening to this thinking like, what is the point?
Yeah, why are we listening to these girls?
Look, I would say that if you're interested in the craft of writing, this is a good book to read.
And if you've been adopted.
Yes, that too.
Or if you, or if, I think I would read this if I was going to Prague and I read it in Prague.
That's also true, yeah.
So anyways, guys, this is our review of The 100-Year Flood by Matthew Salices. Hope you enjoyed it.
I hope you enjoyed it.
Should we have another word?
I don't think so, because I feel like people will cheat and just fast forward to the end this time because they know.
And I was quite disappointed with how little people said ironing board to us.
Yeah.
Maybe like three people. So shout out to, who was the first one?
Alyssa.
Alyssa Himon. Hi.
Thank you for
listening
all the way to the end.
Hey, how many subscribers do we have now?
I have no idea. I haven't checked. Somewhere around 20.
Wow. We're making it, guys. We're making it.
I'm pretty sure that's viral.
To the 28 people out there, just share it with 10 of your friends. Only 10. It's like a pyramid scheme.
Even if only out of sympathy for the fact that we are recording this for the second time, thanks to somebody. All right,
stop it, Heather. You just need to get over it.
I think we need to build a bridge. I think we need to have an offline conversation, you and I, right now. So,
Heather, I think you're holding the door for yourself, but it's not long enough for you to let yourself through.
In the face. Okay? I'm walking through that door, all right?
I'm so glad you live in Korea and I'm in Sydney.
So,
cool.
So, yeah, because it's my job to end this.
We're
going to
end it here.
All right.
Alright, ending it here. Goodbye, guys.
Alright, see you next month, everyone.
Look out for our next one. Bye.